good evening once again to my little ghosties and ghouls, to the very best in high-definition stereo sound broadcast, exclusively on the Para-X Paranormal Network Visions Magazine Radio. Natasha presents you with the very best in accurate and factual news and science in the realm of the paranormal. This is dangerous territory, and Natasha has no fear. Are you listening? Shut up. Stand up. Butch up. Sit down. On tonight's show, Natasha is combining psychics with science. Psychic medium Lynn Orson will discuss Tara's undisclosed location overnight EVP session and will give her audience her psychic impressions of what was going on inside the Hell House of Demons. Next, we will bring on author and lecturer and scientific paranormal investigator David M. Rountree. Mr. Rountree's 258-page book entitled Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting is a must for anyone who wants to chase, experience, and learn about life after death. Buy this book or suffer Natasha's strict discipline of compliance. Are you ordering the book now? Are you reading the book now? Stand up. Watch up. Sit down. All this, plus the lovely Tara and the beautiful Joseph, insolent bastard. In the next 60 minutes of Paranormal Broadcast Excellence, Natasha now presents VMR 29. God help us all. Are you listening? Shut up. Butch up.
Hey everybody, this is Brian J. Cano of Scared and of Sci-Fi's Haunted Collector, and you are listening to Visions Magazine Radio.
I want to know who you're meeting in the cemetery.
I don't have to tell you anything.
Said, what? I was a teenager, something or other with a church fire. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Visions Magazine Radio number 29. Say good evening to everybody, Tara.
Good evening.
There she goes, following directions again. We got a good show here for... Ow! We got a good show for everyone here tonight, I believe so, and we're going to have two guests. The first one is going to be psychic medium Lynn Olson, who is actually a chat room request from VMR 28 of last week. You remember that, Tara?
Yes, I do, because I put out the information. I said, who wants her to come on the show again?
And you do. What she's going to be doing is a psychic, Tara, help me out here, a psychic recap of your undisclosed EVP. Is that correct?
She'll be giving her psychic impressions of what she sees with her, you know, psychic abilities when she listens to the EVP.
Well, this ought to be awful interesting because we had the scientific analysis and everything else. And I want to thank Swampy for giving me a timeline that he provided, and he actually backed up Gary. But I want to get on to the guest today. I want to take it in a different direction. I also want to thank everybody in the chat room for making VMR 28, the Terra Undisclosed EVP show last week, our highest rated show. I was very impressed by that, got the numbers, and it's like, thank you all very much. Kept me from shooting myself in the head. The second guest we're going to have is David M. Rowntree, who is the keynote speaker. I mean, Tara, I, and Gary Kanji spoke at the Beyond the Paranormal event a couple weeks ago. He was the keynote. We're all there to see him and listen to him. Fascinating discussion. In fact, I was so impressed by his seminar, and Tara is so impressed by his book, that we're going to bring him on the show. So you can get a little bit of what his lecture was like, his thinking, his scientific analysis of what we are doing here. So we're not just making mistakes and doing everything in the dark, which we shouldn't be doing anyway. But without further ado, because I want to pack this show full of information tonight, I'm going to have Tara introduce psychic medium Lynn Olson, our first guest. Tara, go ahead.
Medium Lynn Olson is a God-centered psychic medium based out of Washington State. Lynn has been on our show numerous times in the past, and tonight she's here upon request from last week's chat room, as Joe had mentioned. She can be reached via Facebook and on her website, mediumlynolson.com.
Okay, I'm going to let Tara take over this interview because her and Lynn are the spiritualist ones here. I'm just going to be the button pusher in the back unless I come up with something. So without further ado, psychic medium Lynn Olson, here we go.
Hi, Lynn. It's Tara. How are you?
I'm okay.
Well, welcome to VMR Radio.
Thank you.
Well, we sent over to you a rather malicious EVP to listen to, and you did tell me you got some impressions from it, so I wanted to see if you could... I have a timeline here, and maybe you could elaborate on some things that you gave me here. You mentioned horses, and you mentioned some sort of carriage image you were getting.
Yes, I did. Periodically throughout the 14-odd minutes of the EVP, there were sounds of horses' hooves. Sometimes it sounded like one horse, sometimes it sounded like a team. I did see a carriage crashed or turned over in a carriage accident, and I think that the horses were connected, the sound of the horses' hooves were connected to that incident.
We found it interesting that, you know, we had one of our friends, fellow investigators, Gary, heard the horse hooves as well. And I think we had to actually listen to it a second time before we realized, yeah, I guess, you know, that could be the sound of horse hooves.
I found that interesting because I believe that investigators, one of your staunchest skeptics. So it's interesting that both of us heard it. The images and stuff, as far as a carriage accident, a young man who was being sort of shouted over by a dark entity. Those are all my psychic impressions. There's none of that on the tape that you can hear with your ears, as far as I can tell.
Okay, all right. Yeah, well, yeah, that's understandable. I mean, you're getting impressions that the average person wouldn't be getting. But what I found interesting about what you were picking up was that, I guess when something this negative, this type of tragedy happens, that this can, you know, pull in a lot of negative type entities or even the demonic.
I've seen it happen repeatedly, more times than I can count. Tragedy, especially involving fear, death, a lot of blood or violence, tragedy in any form will leave an energetic imprint for a long, long time. And dark entities feed on that pain and fear. And if the people who were involved or who died in the incidents didn't move on, then they just become like ghost batteries of fear who are reliving it over and over. So it's like a dark entity meal ticket.
That's interesting. And I, you know, I'm starting to read more about, you know, demons and that type of subject matter. And it starts to boggle my mind of how there's still a lot of people out there that don't even believe in demons. I'm thinking, how can you really be out there investigating and not come across them?
I suppose there's a number of factors in play. Some things are picked up consistently in the same locations. Other times it's sort of like not so Old Faithful in Yellowstone, the geyser. It used to be the Old Faithful, you would, you know, it would spout up every day or several times a day. And that has changed. That pattern has changed. So I think that there's a parallel between that and paranormal investigating. Sometimes something will be, shall we say, in action or playing like an old record, and you'll be able to pick up on it. And other times it's silent or it's in the background so far you can't pick up on it. It depends on the team, their methods, the equipment used, possibly the time of year, depending upon when a tragedy may have happened at a location, and whether or not they have a sensitive or a psychic with them who has the capabilities of picking up on those energy signatures.
So do you think it's possible for, like, a negative entity or even a demon to be dormant and then something the investigator does that possibly could trigger it?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I saw it happen at Waverly Hills 2 years ago. GAC was at Waverly Hills, and, of course, we were all terribly excited to be there. I was there as a paying member of the public, and I'd been there the year before. So I'd been there in May of 2009, and this was the GAC investigation was May of 2010. And the difference between the 2 years was really eye-opening. The first year, I'd seen a lot more of the patients and had interactions with the spirits of the patients who had died at Waverly. The second year, the really, really dark stuff was stirred up big time. People were getting scratched. One guy got scratched a couple feet in front of my face by someone or something. And I sensed a lot more dark entities, and I saw a lot more of the doctors and staff who I hadn't seen the year before, because I think those ghosts were sort of trying to protect the ghosts of the patients, because there was more dark energy running around. And I think some of the dark energy that was attached to the mass graves, which are historically documented at Waverly Hills, I think some of those were stirred up by GAC, because I had not felt such dark energy the year before, and there had not been scratching, and there was just a lot of really weird, dark stuff going on then. And I think GAC did stir it up. They can be pretty aggressive, and they're provoking. And I think they made the difference.
Yeah, that's what I'm starting to think. You know, a lot of us are going to these same locations. We're all, you know, going to these different places. So we don't know who's been there before us, and we don't know what type of provoking they've done. So we don't a lot of times know what we're getting into.
There were some consistent spirits. There's a spirit, Tina, the wife of the co-owner at Waverly Hills, called Big Black. He hates that name, by the way. His name's Jerry, and he was an orderly at Waverly Hills, and this is what his ghost told me 2 years in a row, okay? And I saw him both years, and he took a very grim, terrible situation and made it a little more bearable for all concerned, because he was a joker and a prankster. And he came back after his death. He survived Waverly Hills. He didn't get TB, but he chose to come back. So he was sort of a gentle giant sort who lightened the load for everyone concerned, even though, you know, he was like on bedpan duty and stuff like that, body transport. I saw him 2 years in a row, the ghost of Molly, a little girl who died of TB. I saw her up on the third floor in the same general area 2 years in a row. So there was some consistency in terms of the resident ghosts, but there's usually more diversity than consistency, depending upon the visit. Regarding the 14 minutes of the EVP that you folks played last week, what I picked up was a very, very aggressive, angry, rage-filled dark entity. And that was pretty apparent to anyone who listens to it, because there's all this growling. It starts out at the beginning of the tape, and it goes on periodically to the very end of the EVP, the recorded session. But as it goes along, it gets louder and more aggressive and more rage, to the point where sometimes I had to take the earphones away from my ears because it was so bloody loud, and the intensity, the energy behind it was so painful. What it was masking is what I found more interesting. There was the ghost of a young man present, and this dark entity was basically growling or shouting over what he was trying to say. What he told me is there had been a terrible carriage accident. It had happened very close to the front of the house, and it involved a fatality, and these were people related to him. There was a little girl that died, and there was also a young woman who I believe was probably his wife and the little girl's mother. I saw the horses moving very fast, and then I saw the carriage tip and roll over onto its side. I believe that for some reason control was lost, and the carriage ended up, at least partially, hitting a gas street lamp that was outside on the street near the residence. So he was saying that, you know, this was his story. He wanted to tell me about these deaths. He was still very sad and caught up in the grief of it. From his clothing, I would put him around the 1910s decade. He was wearing a brown silk, striped silk suit that would have put him as a man of means, probably a businessman of some description. And this was a young family, and it was, you know, three-quarters of it was taken out by a carriage accident. And I think the dark entity that was growling and so angry is feeding off of the continuing energy of the tragedy.
That's really sad when you think about it. I mean, that poor gentleman has been stuck there for that length of time. You said it was around like 1910.
Yeah, between 1910 and 1920 from his clothes is my best educated guess.
So you think it was him and his whole family stuck there, or just him?
I saw the ghost of the little girl pretty clearly. I think they're all stuck. It's like they're reliving the tragedy over and over.
Joe's in the background asking, like, what would cause that for them to just keep being, and I always wonder personally how a person can still maybe, do you think they still think they're, like, I don't know, like, to keep living that over and over again, how wouldn't they realize that it's done with? And
well, that almost has to be taken on a case-by-case basis, like whether they realize where they are in time or whether they're living or dead. Some ghosts don't have a clue. Some are very aware and have watched time go on and decades unfold and are aware of our modern life. Like they aren't startled by a cell phone or modern clothing or anything because they are aware of their place in time, even though they're no longer incarnate. I don't know that there is a purpose. I just think it's an occasional side effect. You know, people, unfortunately, it's part of human life, are dying all the time. So not all of them turn into ghosts, and ghosts, by my definition, are earthbound spirits who are stuck here for whatever reason. And the trick to releasing them is figuring out what the reason is and finding out what has to be done to release it, to release them energetically.
That was pretty much probably covers it. And we really enjoyed having you on and listening to your impressions, because it really does give us a wider, more expansive view of what in the heck is, you know, going on with this EVP. So, you know, we're all getting snippets and hearing this and that, but you're getting more of a full picture. And I think this was really, you know, really great to hear all your different impressions. And then we can learn from that.
Well, ideally, it would be best if that dark entity was removed and that family could be moved on to the other side. It's not a healthy situation, either for the spirits that are stuck here, the ghosts, or the living people living in that residence.
So you consider that probably a threat to anybody that's living there?
I think at the very least it can be an energetic drain and a stress.
Well, I mean, that helps too, you know, us to learn from these types of things as well. We just want to have you give our listeners your website and ways they can contact you.
Absolutely. My website is www.mediumlynolson, and that's LynnOlson.com. I can be found on Facebook under Medium Lynn Olson. And the best way to get a hold of me is probably through my website or through my working email, which is angelshands, and it's angels with a Z instead of an S, angelshands@yahoo.com.
Okay, sounds great. Great to have you back again. You're actually on the show by request. I threw that out there to our listeners last week, and they were all excited to have you back on.
Well, that's great to hear. I appreciate that from them and the chance to weigh in again with you folks.
Okay, Lynn, you have a good night.
You too. Bye.
All right. Obviously, ridiculously fascinating. I want to thank psychic medium Lynn Olson once again for her time on our radio show, Visions Magazine Radio. Our next guest is going to be David M. Rowntree. I'm going to have Tara read his bio. Then I'm going to get him on the phone here, and I think we're all going to learn a lot. David, his articles are still on visionsmagazineonline.com. That would be in the paranormal, or would it be in the paranormal things?
Yes.
Yeah. Anybody who wants to know anything about orbs and wormholes, read those articles. And if you read those articles, you'll really get an insight, a very good insight, because believe me, you know, I almost blew my head off trying to lay out these articles. There's so much of a depth of information here. Visionsmagazineonline.com, you will be able to see and read his articles on orbs and wormholes. It's just textbook stuff. It's really great. It gets rid of all the paranormal hocus pocus and gives you the scientific fact. In fact, you discovered him somewhere along the way. Is that correct, Tara?
I did. I came across him online and asked him to start writing for us, and he was more than happy to do that.
Yes, he was. Some of our most scientific, in-depth articles that we have featured anywhere, both in print and online, and I'm honored that he's a part of Visions Magazine family.
And what you want to, you know, think about is with Visions Magazine and visionsparamag.com, you get both worlds. We look at things from a spiritual perspective, and then we also go, you know, to the scientific way as well.
Exactly, which is what I like, getting through all the bullshit out there in the entertainment and giving us the facts, as well as there can be facts regarding investigating the paranormal. Tara, tell us a little bit about David here.
David was born in Suffolk, Virginia. And since 1976, he's researched paranormal phenomena from a scientific point of view. David is the director of Scientific Paranormal Investigative Research, Information, and Technology, New Jersey Paranormal Resource Group, a professional member of Rhine Research Center, life member of the New Jersey Ghost Hunter Society,
my God,
a member of the Audio Engineering Society, International Frequency Sensor Association, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Wow.
David's primary area of research is the study of electronic voice phenomenon, environmental alterations present during a paranormal event, and the search for the source of these alterations. David lives with his wife and son in Hackettstown, New Jersey. And for more information on his research, visit www.spinvestigations.org.
Okay, and without further ado, David M. Rowntree.
Hello.
Hi, is this David?
Yes.
Hi, it's Tara from VMR Radio. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good, good. Well, I have a bunch of questions here all ready to go if you're ready.
Okay.
All right. All righty. Can you tell us the top three pieces of equipment you would recommend for paranormal investigation and why?
Well, I would have to start out with saying probably the most important thing you can get aside from a decent camera and a decent video camera would be a decent recorder. And then moving from that, I would invest in a good handheld oscilloscope and a MagCheck 95 sensor for looking for EMF. And the reason I recommend that over like an EMF meter or a MEL meter or whatever is because with an oscilloscope, you not only know that you have EMF present, you also know what the frequency of it is and what the actual waveform looks like. So it's pretty easy to eliminate 60-cycle EMF or 60-hertz EMF coming from your home power source as a potential cause for the EMF, the elevated EMF readings the meter is giving you. The meter just doesn't tell you that information. It just tells you you have EMF present.
David, this is Joe, Terra's cohort in crime here. You know, oscilloscopes and all this other waveform monitors, that's a little heavy-handed scientific mumbo-jumbo for a bunch of people that were raised on ghost adventures.
Well, I'm sorry they feel that way, you know? You're either a hobbyist or you're out to find an answer. That's what it boils down to.
I'm good with that.
You know, the problem with mirrors is they don't tell you enough. I mean, you could easily be measuring something that was absolutely normal and associated with the power in your house and think that you had something weird going on, and a meter doesn't, you know, discern the difference, and that's the problem. Telescope, you know exactly what you got.
Let me ask you this. Are there charts where the layman can understand by looking at the oscilloscope or the other device you said? It's like, okay, this is, I mean, just plain as day, like referring to your book, this is normal, this is abnormal. Is there a chart, a basic formula when they start looking at those readings that they can understand and be able to shortcut science class?
Well, you have to have a little bit of knowledge. I mean, you have to kind of know that your house runs off of 60 hertz power. And pretty much, I would hope everyone knows that because it's clearly written on the back of every appliance that you buy and plug in the wall. So 60 cycles is like what the power nationwide is as far as its frequency. But as for an actual how-to, that's really why I wrote the book. I go into the book why, you know, we use what we use, why we use the MagCheck 95 sensor, and why we made it to the oscilloscope. And there's also information on my website in the on the research page where I did a paper about EVP, understanding EVP and stuff. It's called the EVP Project, and I go into how to set that up and how to use it in that article, and that's free online at my website, www.investigations.org. But there isn't a lot out there, Joe. You're right, because there's not a lot of sites that are correlating scientific research with the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no corollary between that information that the average user can go out and get. I mean, and like I said, that was like the motivation for writing the book in the first place, was to give people good, usable, easy to understand, hands-on information at their fingertips that they could use and hopefully give them a better understanding of their equipment and how to use it.
Now, you measure at least 15 different things when you investigate, such as, and this is for the benefit of our listeners that have not yet purchased your book called Paranormal Technology. I'll go over some of those things.
They better get on it.
Barometric.
If they want to understand the rest of this interview, they better have it right in front of them right now.
You're measuring things such as barometric pressure, ions, humidity, temperature, the magnetic field, static electricity, ultraviolet light, EMF, radio frequencies, geomagnetic field, radiation, time shifts, gravity, and cold plasma. Now, what does it mean if just some of these things change and not others?
Well, that's the thing. What we're finding out is that, you know, some of these things that we look for don't actually prove that something paranormal is occurring. It actually debunks that paranormal may be occurring, particularly when we're looking at things like some temperature fluctuations or things like that. One thing by itself really doesn't tell you a whole lot, and it really doesn't mean a whole lot. A couple of things happening really doesn't tell you a whole lot or mean a whole lot, but when you start to get a lot of changes occurring in the environment, specifically, you know, most people aren't going to be out there measuring gravity, for example. Most people aren't going to be measuring time fluctuations. They just don't have that capability or that equipment because it's not available off the shelf at your local ghost hunting store or at www.whateverbuyyourghostequipmenthere.com. So most people are going to be measuring simple things. They'll probably be measuring temperature. They'll probably be measuring barometric pressure. And they'll probably be measuring, you know, EMF. And those three things, while it's interesting, really doesn't give you a whole lot of the picture.
So understanding, you know, elevated gamma radiation, presence of that in someone's living room, which is, you know, unless you live on a thermonuclear minefield or you're living on a uranium mine or something, just doesn't occur in your living room. Or these time fluctuations that occur. The whole thing is it takes a preponderance of evidence to prove that something paranormal has occurred. And you know, incredible claims require incredible evidence to back it up. So it's important, at least if you're trying to compete in the scientific community, to have a wealth of data associated with a perceived paranormal event in order to give it credence as being a paranormal event. But you're right. You know, there are times when you will get some changes in the environment in some areas, and other areas remain unchanged. And in those cases, we start looking for what's causing it. You know, what's causing the temperature to drop 10 degrees, or what's causing the barometric pressure to drop, you know, 5 millibars. You know, and you start looking for a natural explanation, and oftentimes you'll find one. And in those cases, you know, you don't have something paranormal occurring. You've got just something weird going on in the house that's easily explainable.
David, I like the way you put that. What you're basically measuring is natural phenomena, irregularities. And those irregularities perhaps may lead you to a semi-conclusion or a theory that something paranormal is occurring. Am I wording that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, we're monitoring the way the environment based on, you know, a certain level of control situations, like, you know, in your living room, when you go in there and you start taking measurements, everything's generally pretty stable. Well, when something paranormal starts happening, there's a lot of things in the environment that change radically and become unstable. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for those tags to show up, those little nuggets of things going berserk to tell us, hey, something bizarre is going on. Let's see if we can map it out and find out what it is. And, you know, not every time is it a paranormal event. Sometimes we find, you know, pretty bizarre things or conditions in a home that are causing things to happen. I mean, we've encountered wiring issues that created all sorts of havoc with the gear itself. In other words, the EMF was so high from really poor wiring in the house that it rendered it fairly useless, you know, in the environment. And we, you know, told the people, you know, hey, you know, get an electrician in here, fix your electrical problems, and then call us back if you still have a problem. And then, you know, we'll start again in here. But a lot of times we uncover serious health issues in people's homes that are causing paranormal-like conditions to occur.
One thing I did want to harp on, because I really remember that from your seminar, Dave, was a lot of this, 90% of what your findings are pointing toward electromagnetic fields. Am I not correct in saying that?
Yeah, I mean, a big piece of evidence is what goes on in the EMF fields in the environment when this is going on. You know, we have a lot of natural EMF around us all the time from various sources, including background cosmic radiation. I mean, there's all sorts of noise in our environment that is there. We don't hear it, but it's in the EM, you know, spectrum. What happens is when that stuff starts rising out of the noise floor, there's generally something, you know, a reason for it doing that. And that's really what we have to look at, what's causing the changes that are dramatically happening. And the other thing is, too, is 90% of the things that occur during a paranormal event aren't so much the paranormal event itself, but the reaction of the conduit that's allowing the paranormal event to occur and its reaction on our environment. So we're actually measuring how our environment's changing to accommodate this what I call a wormhole opening up.
From reading your book, I discovered that you found flaws with both the K2 meter and the ghost box, which could actually be considered one of the most common types of equipment all of us are running around and using. Now, as far as me and Joe, we do not have any type of ghost box here, but we do have the K2.
Either.
I think most investigators have a K2.
We got two of them.
Could you give us the short version of why these devices could be picking up other things other than spirits or what we, or perhaps some suggestions of what we could use in place of these devices?
Right. Well, the K2 is just really a very cheap EMF meter with no calibration, no shielding, and a very broad frequency response, which means it's going to pick up everything. In other words, if there's a taxi cab driving by and the guy's talking on his cell phone or on his radio, or kids up the street are using a walkie-talkie, it's all going to be picked up by the K2. The K2 is also going to pick up the strongest EMF field that's available, and generally that's house wiring and issues around house wiring. How it's used on TV is just ludicrous. They're using it as an electronic Ouija board, essentially, like the flashlight that they slightly unscrew and get the flash on and off, because there's this thing called the arcing effect based on relative humidity and electricity arcing, which is a perfectly natural event. But because they're not reliable and they're not telling you specifically, they're telling you generalities with a K2 meter. Now, the ghost boxes and stuff, here's the problem with the ghost boxes, you know. Say we are talking to someone that's dead. There's absolutely no way to prove that. A ghost box is literally scanning the AM broadcast band, which is just, you know, consequently, the reason they use that is because it's filled with, what, talk radio, right? So there's going to be a lot of people talking. And by adjusting the scan rate, and shack hacks do the same thing, by adjusting the scan rate, you can get it to pick up words, or you can get it to pick up phonetics. And many of them have it scanned very fast, so they're picking up phonetics. And while you can get some very intriguing information, it's clearly traceable by using an RF spectrum analyzer to a local AM broadcast station. So what's generating the message is the scan rate of the radio or the ghost box itself, and not somebody that's dead. However, suppose that by some strange reason, a dead person could modulate their voice to occur randomly across the AM dial, which is about 1,650 different frequencies. At the exact same moment, your device is doing that randomly and builds a sentence out of it, which is, to me, very astronomically unsound to do. But say that they are. There's absolutely no way to prove that. There's no button that says, oh, this is a dead person, or this is just the AM band. So the evidence is not acceptable by any scientific or research person or organization because they clearly understand how the box works and how it creates the sound that it does. Now, I understand people get some very compelling messages with these. And I would put forward that you can take and cut up a lot of words, kind of like what the Ovilus does. They have a 10,000-word dictionary that the manufacturer selects the words very carefully to put in there. But if you put those words in a big old derby that you buy at the local haberdashery shop, go to a haunted site and reach in and start randomly drawing out pieces of paper with words on them, you'll get some pretty compelling messages from drawing out randomly those words and putting them together. So it's the same sort of principle. It's just being done electronically. So the problem is you can't prove that it's from a dead person. And that's where it falls short of being any kind of acceptable evidence. And they're fascinating. You can artificially manipulate them extraordinarily easy with the right type of walkie-talkie radio and stuff. And I'm not accusing anyone of doing that, but having built one, I can tell you they're very easy to manipulate artificially. You know, things like that. They're not calibrated. There's really no science behind it, and that's why they're really not acceptable scientifically to them.
How come every dead person becomes a scientific electronic engineer as soon as they die, so they can manipulate all this equipment?
Oh yeah, exactly. Or how come that they, you know, that they all come back and give people information on how to build devices to talk to them when they're already talking to them? Mm. You know, that's the thing I never understood. Oh, Edison came back and told me how to build this thing. Oh, really? Well, when Edison was around, they barely had vacuum tubes, so how was he able to, like, magically come up with this technology, you know? And then if you're talking to Edison, what the hell do you need to build the box for?
What do you need the box for? Exactly. Exactly.
So, yeah, you know, you have to kind of take it all with a grain of salt. And what would be a better way of trying to talk to the dead would be to, you know, take and assemble yourself a small little two-way little PA system type thing where you were talking towards the air in front of you using a little speaker, and then having a microphone set up so they could talk back to you using a little speaker. And it would just seem like that would make more sense to me.
Have you had good success with that? Because I read about that in your book.
Yeah, we've had some pretty compelling things occur. And we're playing around with different ways of doing it as far as, like, we started out using these two little Radio Shack amplifiers that you just plug a little mic into it. And the quality was so poor on them that, you know, you really couldn't tell if you were just getting noise or you were getting some kind of EVP or what. But I ended up with a very small little self-powered mixer, and what I would do is I would pan one channel to a speaker that was facing away from me, and then I would have a microphone set up running into the mixer for whatever was there to talk into. And then I had a microphone and a speaker that was panned to the other side. So if someone talked in that microphone, I would hear it out of my speaker, and I would record it too. And I would talk, and it would come out of the other speaker facing out. And, you know, that way you could establish real-time two-way communication using the EMF being transmitted by the speaker itself, not just by the sound it was generating. And we've had some hits where we felt like we had an intelligent response. But it's just too early right now to come to any kind of real conclusion with it. But it is kind of neat that we are getting some compelling, you know, evidence that we think eventually may prove that that's an effective way of establishing a form of ITC.
David, I got a question. Obviously, our Visions Magazine radio audience loves EVPs. Could I have your short version, layman's terms, of what you scientifically believe an EVP is and how it's created?
Okay, sure will. A few years back, we were doing some experiments to try to prove what EVP was, because back in the 70s when I started working on it, I did a series of experiments with a bell jar where we fitted a microphone inside of a bell jar and removed all the air from it. And we went to a location where we had captured EVP in the past, and sure enough, we captured an EVP on this microphone that was inside a vacuum. Well, sound doesn't travel in a vacuum, so we knew for sure it wasn't sound, but we couldn't prove what it was. Now, I suspected what it was that it was EMF in the voice spectrum that was creating the EVP, because a dynamic microphone has a voice coil that will respond to EMF. It took a long time before we could prove that, because we had to kind of wait for technology to catch up with us. And around 2005, I built a device called the EMF EVP correlator, which essentially allowed me to use a microphone, use a detection coil, so that I could record both what the microphone picked up and what the coil picked up, and then compare those two to the recordings to see if I had an EVP, and to compare the EVP file from the microphone to the EMF file that the coil picked up. And we found that they essentially were fairly identical. The differences being that the EMF had a little more background noise in it, but the actual voice pattern that showed through was an exact match of the pattern that we got with the microphone. And since then, we've done several other experiments, and other people have reproduce those experiments and come to the same conclusion that the cause of EVP is EMF in the voice spectrum. Now, where it comes from is another story we'll get into in a little while.
Go ahead, Derek.
Okay. What would you consider some of the more common mistakes that these days us paranormal investigators might be making?
Oh, good question.
Jumping to conclusions. People will take a little bit of perceived evidence and really run with it and build a mountain out of a molehill. You know, a little piece of evidence. And while I believe that EVP and the study of EVP is a very vital element in the fact of how we're going to discover the nature of what paranormal is, a lot of people will take one or two little nuggets of information and build an entire scenario around those two little nuggets of information or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the thing is you have to have a lot of things together. And even though you might have EVP, EVP is interesting, but were you doing an RF sweep to see if there was perhaps a natural occurrence with the voice that you recorded? If you didn't, then you have eliminated every possible natural cause for what you recorded. So the problem is, you know, like, not thoroughly investigating the environment and jumping to conclusions based off a small amount of evidence. And I understand how it happens, because people get excited. I mean, when someone makes a discovery, particularly in a spooky old place, it's exciting. particularly to people who are new to the field or who have just maybe started investigating or don't really understand or comprehend everything about the equipment they're using or what it really means. So it's very easy to jump to a conclusion. And we are constantly, like, debunking the things that we find because, I mean, we've been doing it for a long time, number one, and we've learned a whole lot of things that can cause weird things to happen that aren't weird. And once you start doing that, then the evidence that you do have in the end of that is truly powerful evidence. I mean, it's evidence that you can show to a scientist and say, hey, explain this, you know? And they look at you kind of quizzically and they don't say anything. And that's the stuff you want.
David, again, referring to these, the multitude of television entertainment paranormal shows that we see, usually a third of the show is dedicated to the history of a supposedly haunted location. In your scientific work, does the history of a location have any validity in an investigation?
Sure, there's a place for it. Does it have the weight that some people put to it? Probably not. We tend to do a historical investigation after we do the physical investigation.
Hmm.
And the reason that we do that is A, number one, so we're not colored by what we find out about the history of the place.
Uh-huh.
And two, so we can compare what we find in the history to the evidence already gathered so that there's no biasing of the evidence and there's no trying to make the evidence fit into a pattern or whatever. We look for historical references that may reinforce evidence that we get, but we don't let the historical references drive the search for that evidence. And I think it's important to have that kind of approach to keep your objectivity, because it's very easy to get biased and have a confirmation bias type situation occur in the field and have it color your work. And that's specifically something we work very hard to avoid.
I actually, David, think that's absolutely brilliant. Do the scientific investigation first, then look up the history to see if it correlates. So basically, every damn show on air is doing it ass backwards.
Remember, it's drama. They're selling cornflakes. So their idea is to prepare the audience for the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to, you know, throw the bait out, you know, for the fish. That's why they do it that way. Now, I'm arguing in their favor because I really don't know what the motivation is behind it, but I'm assuming that that's what's driving that type of aspect to it. We have a historian in our organization who is a, you know, really a professional historian. And what happens is she goes in while we're doing an investigation and not even there and starts the process. Oftentimes, she doesn't get finished with her process until we have already gone through the month-long process of analyzing the evidence, categorizing it, throwing out the stuff that's no good, and then assembling the stuff that we think is good. So by the time we finish our research, it's generally when she finishes hers, or it's close to the same time when it occurs. Then we all get together, and she shares what she has, and we share what we have, and then we kind of correlate any commonalities that occur. And that part of it just makes it, it's very powerful when you find hits.
I think it's
in other words, if you get a name or something like that, and then she discovers that that was the name of the third owner of the home that was murdered in their sleep. You see what I'm saying, though? It makes it
exactly.
Far more compelling when it's done that way than if you're going there looking for a John Smith who was murdered in his sleep. So, you know, we don't know what we're looking for. We're looking for what's there, not necessarily what we think it should be. And I think it makes the whole thing a lot more honest.
I think it's absolutely brilliant. Brilliant.
That's being objective. I mean, I preach that all through the book, being objective about it, and it's a difficult task to be objective.
No, it's just a bunch of common sense, Dave. I mean, you do the scientific experiment first, and not doing the history first does not color your expectations and force those expectations which could be erroneous. I think it's brilliant.
You know, that's part of the objective process, but, you know, a lot of people, you know, it's a regimented system, and a lot of people who don't have a background in scientific research and stuff, they really don't, it doesn't cross their mind. That part of it doesn't cross their mind, and it's not their fault. It's just the fact that they're not exposed to that type of methodology in other disciplines. So, I mean, my team is gifted in the fact that everyone on it is coming from a scientific discipline of some kind. So we all have the same methodologies, just from a different disciplined approach. So it all kind of works out. We all understand totally what we're doing, and we're all doing the same methods over and over again so that all the evidence fits into the scheme of things, and it all goes together, regardless of whether you do a house in Seattle, Washington, or you do a factory in Key West, Florida. Because of the methodologies used to compile and collect the evidence, it all fits into to the same mold so that you can use them comparatively to try to prove your point. And they don't show that stuff on TV.
Now, this is an important question because since we do have the magazine, everybody wants to show me their orbs. So I have to bring up...
Show me your orbs, baby.
I have to bring up the orb question. Can you tell us your perception of orbs as far as what they might be and how to differentiate an orb that may actually have real significance to an investigation? You use the terms dust orb and plasma orbs in your book.
Right. Well, see, I would direct people to go to your website and read the article that was posted there a couple years ago about the whole orb research phenomena that
That's
we did.
True.
But having said that, in the nutshell, like I said, I've always believed that there's no extremes in any kind of research. And, you know, there's two camps in the whole orb thing, the whole orb controversy. There's the photographer's camp who says, oh, no, they're all just dust or pollen in front of the lens or lens flare or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the spiritual types who are, you know, it's my dead Aunt Mary.
That's
can
you.
See her face in the orb, the little smiley face, so I know it's her, you know. And I always figured the truth kind of somewhere in between. So we designed a couple of experiments. One was the two-camera shoot, in which we would hook two cameras up on tripods in a room and have them maybe 8 or 10 feet apart, but both looking at the same area of the room. And we would hook them up to a photographer trigger so that we could synchronously shoot pictures in both cameras at the same time. And we would just routinely take pictures all night long. As I suspected, we would catch a bunch of orbs in one camera and not in the other. And, of course, that was dust or pollen or whatever. But every once in a while, we'd catch a single orb in both cameras that was roughly in the same position of the room. And that couldn't have been dust. So we kind of knew that, yeah, there was something to the orb question, but it was nowhere near as prevalent as people believed it to be. Trying to pick a real orb out of a dust orb is impossible from a single photograph. And that led, of course, to another experiment where I kind of put a hypothesis forward that what could it really be? And I thought that it had to be some kind of plasma, possibly cold plasma. And so I had to sample it. And again, you know, the funny story about me watching Ghostbusters one night and building this device that looked essentially like a bazooka that was attached to a shop vac.
The orb sensor.
And I had these two measuring grids inside the tube. I ran around in a couple of different investigations looking for an orb to suck in and try to measure it. And it was unsuccessful the first few times I did it. And then one night I was at an investigation and all of a sudden the needle on the meter went all the way over to the right, pegged, and smoke came out of the meter. So I had sucked something in that was of a very high potential. And we got to working on it, and the more we worked at it, we realized it was probably cold plasma. The plasma was kept stable by an encasing EMF field. Go figure. We get a lot of high EMF on a site. So, hey, you know, maybe that's one cause of the EMF is the stabilizing field around these plasma orbs. And the orbs tend to radiate in the ultraviolet spectrum, so they're not visible to the human eye, but cameras will pick them up. That's kind of where we're at with that. You know, it's easy to show people a picture and say, hey, look at this orb, you know. It's got to be haunted. Well, no, it doesn't. It's probably dust unless you have two pictures from two different angles showing that orb in both pictures. Then I would say, hey, yeah, you got something going on there. You got some kind of cold plasma activity, which is indicative that you got something bizarre going on.
Do you feel we can encounter the demonic or other malicious entities on a paranormal investigation? And if yes, how would you actually be able to scientifically tell they're present?
In the last probably 20-some years or so, I have not encountered anything of that nature. I did encounter something of a demonic nature in 1985 with some friends of mine. I was a different kind of person back then. I was involved in not just the scientific aspect of the research. I was also doing a metaphysical thing at the time. And the thing about it is that I'm currently working on a book with another person who was with me when we encountered this thing. And we're going to detail exactly everything that we did. And it's actually a pretty interesting story, whether you believe it or not. So we feel like that, you know, it'll be an entertaining story regardless of whether people believe it or not, but it is absolutely true. And we used a lot of different things to get rid of this thing. And it was not an easy process. It involved dealing with a lot of different people contributed bits and pieces to the end methodology that was used. And all I can say is that, you know, there's a lot of people running around claiming to be demonologists. And many of these people read a book, and that's how they consider themselves to be a demonologist. Or, you know, very few of them have had formal training as a demonologist. You have to go to a seminary or to a religious school to get that kind of training, or be a disciple of someone in a shamanic tradition that teaches you proper methodologies to use in manipulating the natural world. In order to deal with these things. And if you don't have that capability, one day you are going to get really badly burned dealing with these type of energies. All I can say is that there are some things out there that there are no known banishments for. So it's not like you can go to a book and or take the Bible or whatever and get rid of it. It doesn't work. So when those things happen, you have to fall back on your ingenuity and research and talking with other people and coming up with a variety. It's kind of like medicine. Sometimes you encounter a disease that the penicillin just doesn't work on. And then you have to search for the right combination of things to get rid of it. And it's the same way with this type of activity. There is no one answer to get rid of all of it. Yeah, some of it you can get rid of with this, and some of it you can get rid of with that. But there's some of it that people just really don't know how to get rid of it. And you have to fall back on your own wiles and ingenuity to get rid of it. And this particular story is about such a case as that.
Now, I was really happy when I found out you believe in psychics, which is good because a lot of the people that subscribe to scientific methods just don't. And I like that you test things out, the fact that you tried out the dowsing rods before pronouncing them one way or the other. You claimed that those worked, which has made me happy too because I like to use dowsing rods. Now, in your book, you do have a chapter on psychics. And the one thing that made a lot of sense to me is how they can actually kind of the electromagnetic energy is affecting them. I have a daughter that she can hear it. It's like a sound to her. So she said if she's standing outside of a house, it's like a kind of like a buzzing noise or something in her head. She'll know if their television's on or not. She'll tells me.
Oh yeah. And believe it or not, a lot of psychics and mediums hear things that other people don't hear, and it drives them crazy sometimes. I know a lot of psychics who are real and have a very high hit rate. And they perceive things that other people do not. It's that simple. The whole series of experiments that we've started doing, studying this phenomena, indicates that these people are gifted with the ability to receive a certain low-frequency transmission. Now, they get their information, kind of like a TV set gets their picture and their sound. They pick up this signal, and inside their brain, they are seeing and experiencing like a movie. And that information is being broadcast to them from, you know, points unknown. But they are able to receive the information, and either they witness it like they're watching a movie, they're immersed in it as if they are in an environment that's going on around them, like at Epcot Center, for example, or they're part of it and become a part of a victim or a part of a character in it, and experience it from their point of view. And it's all done by the perspective or the point of view that's transmitted to them. And some people see it in black and white. Some people see it in Technicolor. Some people have sound. Some people don't. Some people just get it kind of empathically as far as what people say or think. Some people hear it in their ears, actually. They perceive that they're hearing it. It's a fascinating thing. but it seems to be related to this kind of low-frequency carrier that has information riding on it. And whenever that's present, they're getting their information.
David, we're at the final minutes of the show here. I want to thank you for some incredible information. Basically, it was a nutshell version of your book. I try to keep Visions Magazine Radio as bullshit-free as possible. Give them the facts, and you were a big part of that. Closing minutes, please tell everybody how they can get this fantastic book that every paranormal investigator should own. If you don't own the book, you're doing yourself an injustice, and you're following erroneous leads. Tell them how to get the book, how to find you on tour, and follow your works that are just absolutely incredible.
Well, thank you, Joe. Yeah, the book is available at any online bookstore. One of your favorites. It's available at Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble. Just go in, type paranormal technology in my name, David Roundtree, and it'll take you right to the book, no matter what site you're on. You can also go to my site, click on the book image on the front page at www.spinvestigations.org, and it will take you to a free preview page with all the purchase links underneath the free preview. And you can check out my website. I have a calendar there. It kind of tells you what I'm doing, what I'm up to. If I'm going and doing a convention somewhere, it's in there. If I'm doing an interview, it's in there. And there's a lot of good information about the research that we're doing and the research that other people are doing in there. So I would, you know, advise people to check it out because the site's free. And go read your wonderful online magazine. I have several articles in there as well, so... and I want to thank you guys for publishing some of my articles back when you guys were starting out. I thought that was really great.
Yeah, I still go back and look at those and just like, wow, this is, you know, it never goes out of date.
No one's done anything like this. That's what's cool. He's been with us since day one.
That's true.
Well, you know, I think it's important that we share our work. And I think it's important that other people reproduce it. And I try to facilitate that as much as possible by explaining in great detail how we do things so other people can do it too.
That's why we're all doing this. This is why this damn radio show exists in the first place. Dave, what can I say but, you know, fantastic interview, pal. You got a red carpet. Anytime you want, you come up with a new theory, you just want to bullshit about a new theory you got and get it out there in front of the audience, we are here for you, my friend.
Absolutely, and thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure talking with you guys, and it was great finally meeting you guys in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it was our honor. I enjoyed the seminar profusely. You know, I enjoyed our question and answer banter after the show, and man, I can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to be coming back to Pittsburgh at least one more time that I know for sure, and possibly another time next year for a convention there that some people are trying to put together. So looking forward to seeing you guys when I come back.
It's a deal. Just keep us in mind.
Yeah, let us know. Facebook us.
Yeah, let us know on Facebook. What's your Facebook, David?
It's just my name. You can't miss it.
David M. Roundtree.
David.M.Roundtree, and you'll go to my page.
And it's without the D. I always try to put a D in your name, and I'm like, there's no D.
No, you won't find it that way. You'll get a syntax error. But, yeah, no, it's easy to find. In fact, you can Google me, and it'll probably blow you away. But, yeah, it's a pleasure being with you guys. You guys are great.
Can't thank you enough, pal.
It's a lot of fun having you on the show and meeting you also.
Yeah, it was great.
Have a great night.
Have a good one, Dave. Well, I want to thank our guest tonight, psychic medium Lynn Olson, and also paranormal researcher and author David M. Roundtree. We actually really try to get you the best people on here, and we hope you enjoyed the interviews. And since Joe's not around, I'm going to sneak in one of my quotes tonight, so get ready.
Hey, wait a minute. What about me? Wait a minute. My quote is always, if you don't stand for something, you fall for everything. But nobody listens. What do you got, Tara?
Now you must remain totally silent, no interruptions.
No. Go ahead. It's my radio show, damn it.
It's a quote by Gandhi. Be the change you want to see in the world.
What does that mean?
You would never know. You would never understand.
And on that note, I'll never understand. Good night, everybody. Say good night, Tara.
Good night. No.